higher beings from the universe stopped coming to the Earth planet. The flying aerial vehicles had firstly been designated as Rath, which means vehicle or carriage, later becoming known as Vimana or Vimana. It's usually pronounced either way. I've heard it pronounced different ways too, but primarily they're either referred to as the Ratha or the Vimana. Now, when I was in India about a year ago in 1989, I went to a sacred city of Vrindavan, where Krishna actually grew up and had his pastimes on earth, and I talked to some very old holy men there, and this is a very interesting story for those of you who have followed the UFO phenomenon. You may remember the book Chariot of the Gods by von Däniken. That was one of the original books that kind of started the whole search into the UFO phenomena and its mysteries about Krishna and Rama and the Vimanas and all these things. Well, when I first approached these old sadhus, these old saintly people in Vrindavan, I showed them some pictures of UFOs, and they said, oh, and they said, Deva Rath, which means Deva means God, and Rath, as we just described, means vehicle or carriage. So they described these things, and they kind of laughed and said, oh, they come here all the time to the birthplace of Sri Krishna, to feel the energy of the birthplace of Sri Krishna. To them, it was a common thing, seeing these, what they described as Devarath. Now, Devarath, literally translated, means chariot of the gods. So a lot of this information is where the von Däniken theories came out originally and stirred up all this interest.
I suppose in the meantime the general has borrowed heavily from the Frenchman.
Very heavily.
I noticed he asked after Granny. He must be waiting for her to go so the general can pay off.
When he finds out I'm in the will, he'll be after me. Alexei, I'm not sure whether I shall marry him or not.
How can you talk that way? Would you really marry the highest bidder?
It does annoy you, doesn't it?
I love you. I love you, Pauline, except on that.
Well, as long as you're useful to me, I must have you about. Here, take these 700 florins.
They're yours.
But of course they are. Take them to the casino. Go and play. Win as much as you can at roulette. I must have money.
Possessing speed faster than the mind. This area vehicle was triangular, large, three-tier, which means three levels, uneven, and was piloted by at least three persons. It had three wheels and were probably withdrawn during aerial flight. In one verse, the chariot is said to have had three columns, and it was generally made of any one of the three kinds of metals, gold, silver, or iron. But the metal most commonly used was gold, and the Vedic texts describe it as being for the purpose of making the craft look beautiful. Long rivets were attached to it to close off the layers of the craft, and the chariot contained honey or liquid that was served to the beings who would ride on the craft. Possessing speed faster than the mind, it moved like a bird in the sky, soaring towards the sun and the moon, and used to come down to the earth with a great sound. A lot of times in the modern UFO phenomena, we hear about the great sounds that are associated with the spacecraft, and this is also described in the ancient Veda. Now, interestingly enough, for those of you who are perhaps involved in studying ancient medicine and things like these, there is a description here that the chariot had three types of food, liquid fuel, in other words, in three tanks placed above, and in a fourth vessel was filled with soma rasa. Now, soma rasa, believe it or not, is an ancient psychedelic liquid taken from this special plant that is very rare. It grows high in the Himalayas in India. It's practically impossible to find now. But there were ancient rituals with this psychedelic liquid that the yogis would take after practicing austerities for a long time, and they would travel out of their bodies taking this soma rasa.
I wish to explain that there's no pun intended, nor any offense intended, certainly, though it is true that you, in your way, are most nourishing and are able to turn the apparent grass into the richest of cream. Very well. Would you care to give us another question there? Don't. You're doing very well indeed, and you're giving an example we can all relate to, me included. But go ahead. All right, let us just specify the question a little more. You go to Gila you do not believe in, come out feeling lousy. Go to Gila you do believe in, come out feeling great. Have you got it straight now? Good. Something like that, all right. My answer would be something like this, but do you have any more? Have any more of the question? We want to have all our question before we start on the answer here. I will try my damnedest, okay? If I don't answer at all, then you let me know. The point almost is your question almost answers itself. It is hard to express a question when you already have the answer sitting flopping in your lap. It's awkward. Basically, your answer is a clever, or your answer is a riddle of your question. Let me explain it this way. If you do not believe in a healer, then that healer does you no good. You believe in another healer and you feel fine. What is the connection between the two practitioners? The answer, of course, is only one body went to both, and that is the connection, the you. Therefore, the degree to which you believe in yourself is how much the healing is going to take. You see, it is not the healing that is given to you that heals you. Many of you here already know it is the healing that you choose to accept. In my book, I am writing a book, or dictating one when our friend has the time to take it down, I point out that all of you constantly are putting overlays of meaning on life around you, on the symbols around you. To some of you, a given flower will represent a concept. To a different individual in this room, that same flower will evoke memories of a wedding, hence love, or a senior prom, hence romance, for example. And so, of a single flower that I might hold out to you here, would be a number of private and individual interpretations quite apart from, let's say, the traditional symbolism of that flower in mythology or tradition. Individual layers of meaning, in other words, is apart to collective layers of meaning.
Be kind to yourself. It is only one and perishable
of many on the planet. Thou art that one that wishes a soft finger tracing the line of feeling from nipple to pubis. One that wishes a tongue to kiss your armpit. A lip to touch your cheek inside your whiteness thigh. Be kind to yourself, Harry Fainlight, because unkindness comes when the body explodes, napalm, cancer, and the deathbed in Vietnam is a strange place to dream of palm trees leaning over and angry American faces grinning with sleepwalk terror over your last eye. Be kind to yourself, because the bliss of your own kindness will flood the police tomorrow, because the cow weeps in the field and the mouse weeps in the cat hole, because the rain comes over Guatemala and washes all the god statues away in the next 1,000 years. Be kind to this place, which is your present habitation, with derrick and radar tower and flowers in the ancient brook. Be kind to your neighbor who weeps solid tears on this television sofa. He has no other home and hears nothing but the hard voice of telephone. Click, buzz, switch channel, and the inspired melodrama disappears, and he's left alone for the night. He disappears in bed. Be kind to your disappearing mother and father, gazing out the terrace window as milk truck and hearse turn the corner and say no goodbye. Be kind to the politician weeping in the galleries of Whitehall, Kremlin, White House, Louvre, and Phoenix Terrace, aged, large-nosed, angry, nervously dialing the bald voice box connected to electrodes underground, converging through wires vaster than a kitten's eye can see on the mushroom-shaped ear lobe under the ear of the sleeping Dr. Einstein. Crawling with worms, crawling with worms, crawling with worms, the hour has come. Sick, dissatisfied, unloved, the bulky forehead of Captain, Premier, President, Sir, Comrade, Fear. Be kind to the fearful one in front of you who remembers the lamentations of the Bible and the prophecies of the crucified Adam, son of all the porters and charmen of Belgravia. Be kind to yourself who weep under the moon and hide your bliss hairs under raincoat and suede Levi. For this is the joy to be born, the kindness received through strange eyeglasses on a bus in Kensington, the finger touch of the Londoner on your thumb that borrows a light for your cigarette, the smile of morning at Newcastle Central Station when long-haired Tom Blonde husband greets the bearded stranger of telephone, and the boom-bomb that bounces in the joyful bowels as the Liverpool minstrels of Cavern Think raise up their joyful voices and guitars in electric Afric hurrah for Jerusalem. The saints come marching in, twist and shout, the gates of Eden are named in Albion again. Hope sings a black psalm from Nigeria, and a white psalm echoes in Detroit and re-echoes from Nottingham to Prague, and a Chinese psalm will be heard if we all live our lives for the next 6 decades. Be kind to the Chinese psalm and the red transistor in your breath. Be kind to the monk in the five spot who plays loud and chord bangs on his vast piano, lost in space on a stool and hearing only himself in the nightclub universe. Be kind to the heroes that have lost their names in the newspaper and hear only their own supplication for love, the peaceful kiss of sex in the giant auditoriums of planets. Hear only the myriad nameless voices crying for kindness in the orchestra, crying for hope of their own joy, screaming in anguish that bliss come true and birds sing another 100 years to their white-haired babes, and poets be fools of their own desire. Oh, Anacreon and angelic old Shelley, guide these new nippled generations on spaceships to Mars' next universe. The prayer is to man and girl, the only lord of the kingdoms of feeling, Christ of their own living ribs.
You are now totally relaxed and totally healed. Totally relaxed and totally healed. And as you are relaxed, think about your feet for a moment. Be aware of them. Think about the job they do for you. How quietly and silently they do it. They may ache from now in vain, but they never complain. Think how wonderful your feet are, how beautifully they are put together, and all that they do for you. And your ankles with their flexibility, always there for you, always allowing you to stretch and to reach and to stand taller than you really are.
I started with 20 florins uneven.
Right about you.
I won, doubled my bet and played again. Again I won, and again. I should have gone away, but a strange sensation arose in me. A sort of defiance of fate. A desire to challenge it and put my tongue out at it. I laid down the largest stake allowed. 4,000 florins.
Had meant so much to me because I think they, to a large extent, it really kept me sane because they gave me the awareness that there were other people outside of my little fish pond swimming in the larger ocean who had felt these things, observed these things, articulated things, knew about these things and so forth. And that was a great consolation.
When you were at medical school, was it a natural progression that you moved into psychiatry, or did something particular happen to you as a medical student that led you to go in this direction?
Not so much that anything particularly happened. I think I only retrospectively discovered that psychiatry was in a sense my natural habitat. I'd gone into medicine in the first place as a combination of my own ambitions, if you like, and my parents. In medicine I felt that I wanted to find out about life. I wanted to find out directly about death and suffering and birth and other matters, other subjects generally speaking at university one can study without being enrolled. At least some literature, for instance, is up for grabs. You don't have to go to university to become a writer, but there were some things that one was precluded from, and psychiatry seemed to be that branch of medicine that was gave explicit recognition to different varieties of misery and suffering, and so a great deal of medicine is not so much trying to come to an understanding of these matters, but simply as far as one can contribute physically, eliminate, and that's fine. But that wasn't so much my metier.
This liquid beverage was available on the Vimana, probably for the purpose of helping the people on it be prepared when the craft would pick up speed or travel through different dimensions to be able to dematerialize their body at a quicker rate. And then in describing the Vimana, we have different astounding descriptions of all the parts of them. Now, it makes you wonder if they had all these Sanskrit names for the different parts and their exact description, what they did. It really lends a lot of credibility to the fact that these objects did exist. One part, I'll just describe a few of them, there's over 50 of them. One part was known as the Visvakriyandarpana, possibly a telescope-like instrument for viewing various actions of the world. The Shakya Karshanat Yantra, which was a mirror for attracting energy. In other words, it was a mirror-like device that would attract energy, possibly solar-type energy, out of the sky into the Vimana. The Puspini, or Pingala Darpana, which was an instrument for seeing lightning and controlling its effects on the Vimana. The Viju Vadashika, which was an apparatus having 12 types of electricity flowing through it. Now, this is something still unknown to modern science. Another object was described as the Patikabraka, which was a sheet of mica-like surface for use in the airplane's internal and external use for attracting solar power, solar energy. And then there was the Apashmara, which was possibly an exhaust-type device placed at the junction of the pipes where the solar energy was being attracted. And then one I think is very interesting is the Stambana Yantra, which was an apparatus for arresting motion like a brake. In other words, these craft, according to Veda, would be flying at rapid speeds and could apply this particular device, known as the Stambana Yantra, and come to immediate halt in the middle of the sky. Now, those of you who have studied the UFO phenomenon at all, seen films and different things, there you can see and hear that the UFO, this is performed all the time, where they're traveling very rapidly in all kinds of different motions, and all of a sudden they'll come to an immediate stop, stand still right in the sky, hovering, and then take off again.
But he's there, and it's vastly possible to pick up things from Cheever that you can use. There are a lot of writers who fall even into the second rank, who aren't there with Chekhov and Hemingway and Carey, but whom you pick up something from and remember them because of. You can't end a sentence like that. The hell with it. Then there's a third group, the writers that you aren't like and don't learn anything from. I keep, when I wrote this down, I made a point, it's not necessarily an insult, but it is. Really, it is. And this covers a lot of people at random. William Styron, whom I admire, am not like, respect, and have never learned a damn thing from. John O'Hara, about whom I can only say two of the things I'm not like, and I never learned anything from him. James Gold Cousins, Herbert Gold, the great variety of people, some good, some bad. But the point is that they have almost no relation to you, they just go by.
And your calves so strong. Even if you aren't particularly a muscular person, your calves are so very strong, carrying so much of your weight and what you consider your burden. And then again, your knee is so flexible. The alternation between the solid foundation and the flexible connector. The knee is so flexible between the solid calves and the solid thighs. And the thigh is so powerful. So powerful, such endurance, such strength. Connected then to the hips, the flexibility once again. The vulnerability of the hips. The rotating, bending. How wonderful your hips are. What they give you. What they allow. And through the pelvic area upwell, through the solar plexus. The vitalness, the vulnerability of all those internal organs protected by simple skin. You don't have an entire solid stomach or bone, but just skin, gently stretched across, sometimes totally, sometimes not, but there. And a cage of ribs to protect the heart and lungs. But not a solid mass of steel or solid bone, not a shell as the tortoise, but a lace-like cage that gently supports the heart and the lungs and other organs so vital to your existence. Easily punctured, easily damaged, yet strong and flexible. And as you exhale, the cage closes in on you. And as you inhale, the cage expands, and now you know the beauty of its lace-like, cage-like quality.
An old familiar favorite. We've had many requests for this. It's a simple little sentimental song. And I certainly hope all you sentimental folks out there are going to enjoy it. Ready, fellas? Let's go.
Leeward, a stale smell came from the tubby steamer that rode at anchor with a yellow quarantine flag drooping from the foremast.
Look at them immigrants. I'd give $1 million to know what they came for.
Just for that, Pop, $1 million? It's a land of opportunity.
One thing I do know. When I was a boy, it was the wild Irish came in the spring with the first run of the shed. Now, there ain't no more shed. And them folks, Lord knows where they come from.
Oh, what's the difference, Pop? They're here. It's a land of opportunity.
Vedas are quite astounding because they describe a lot of these things that were in the Vedas that are being observed now in the modern UFO phenomenon. Now consider this, if you will. Bombay, September 21st, 1952, an article appeared in the newspaper that described that an aeroplane based on the sutras of the Vimanaka Sastra of Maharishi Bharadwaj, the manuscript of which was recently discovered by the director of the International Academy of Sanskrit Research, that there was a Vimana that was actually flown in Bombay during 1890. This information is contained in a research article in this week's issue of the Vidhata, a leading Maharashtra daily paper in Bombay. Now, the article was written under the contribution of Sri Lalubhai Kamsar, who was a studying of the Vimanas for quite some time, and he discovered that in 1890, a man named Sri Talpade first constructed a model of an aircraft in the lines laid down by the Vimanaka Sastra. The model was exhibited in an exhibition arranged by the Bombay Art Society in the 1890s. Following his success, Mr. Talpade constructed a bigger aeroplane with the help of his wife, who was also a great Sanskrit scholar. He was also assisted by a friend and an architect from the Bombay School of Art. Now, what he had done was constructed this plane based on the descriptions of the Marucha Saka and the Pushpa type of Vimanas, which were part of the Vedic knowledge. And the general idea of the plane can be found in the 20th Adhyaya of the Rig Veda. That was where the general description was given. I've described to you some of those parts that were in there. Now, the plane, when it was complete, was shown to the late Justice Mahadeo Ranande, and he took him and demonstrated the actual movement of the craft to him, and he became so impressed, this Chief Justice, this judge, that he thought he should invite European experts to proceed further. But Mr. Talpati did not agree to that because he thought it would be a sign of inferiority on their part and that the Vedic knowledge was sufficient for them to construct it.
Every student able to pass the aptitude test, able to stay in school forever. Medicare, antibiotics in every glass of drinking water. Tranquilizers added to the television dinners. Birth control pills in the booze. The president was willing to go even further to make the young people of America happy. Well, conceive him making a speech. Let us reason together. Freedom is indivisible. Marijuana might be just such a freedom. But there are those who argue with justice. I'm imitating President Johnson now. But there are those who argue with justice that marijuana is passed from mouth to mouth. That is, by common consent, unsanitary. Therefore, I propose Congress to draw up law requiring marijuana to be marketed solely in suppositories. There would be a recreation program for all American children. Mass calisthenics and air-conditioned stadiums would blast over dome. The majors would have 82 baseball teams in each league. And the additional teams would take their names from the new housing complexes built around shopping centers. The teams would be called Bypass 60, Ramp 6, Belt 1, Lower Alternate Freeway 4, Coral Gate Arms. Colleges would look like factories. The housing projects would keep looking like prisons. Corporation office buildings would be indistinguishable from the colleges. Not even an airline hostess would know where the airport ended and the motel bedroom began. The sexual revolution would push on. Ladies' magazines would wonder whether the orgy had become a vital solution to suburban life. If there would be statisticians to point out that the modern orgy grouping showed an average of 8 people and 1 erection. Still, State Department intellectuals could point out on their orientation tours through the state universities of America that the sexual revolution was just begun and ways would be found to increase vitality. Camp would have moved on to the happy hunting ground of old art movements. A new art movement would be in. It would be called shit.
Or allegorical overlay on everything, including your doctors and your healers. If you do not believe in a healer, often you will negate anything that individual can give you, even as you would turn down, you might say, a marriage proposal from an individual you thought was a real jerk.
to a reliable, informed source at a major university the true identity of a mysterious Watergate informer, codenamed Deep Throat, was a member of Nixon's cabinet at that time, Alexander Haig.
And you appreciate your body. As you move now to think of your shoulders and the burdens they carry, real or illusion, the responsibility that you shoulder, adultly or otherwise, and the power and the ability of those shoulders to do so much, and the attachment of those arms, those very important arms with their fingers. Maybe your arms aren't as beautiful as you'd like them or as powerful as they should be, but they work. And maybe the arms, the skin is not as soft or as muscular, but they do their function beautifully. And they connect to the shoulders and right in the middle, that little column that you call your neck, holds upon the top of it in a perfect balance. Your head, not tipped to one side or leaning this or that, but balanced there, elegantly, on a little column, a little cord that turns and twists and reaches this way and that. Far more intricate than any mechanics, far more beautiful. And your head, holding the brain, and the messengers to the brain of ears and eyes, and tongue with teeth, and nose. You are aware of yourself, and beautifully relaxed.
When I was my first year as a medical student, my father had what would now be called a bit of a nervous breakdown. It wasn't a mental breakdown. He became very anxious at the point of about to get the job he had been after for years and years when his boss was leaving. And he became convinced that his boss was going to do everything to stop him getting that job. And this reduced him to a state of trembling and continued agitation for the best part of 3 months. So, he was in a sense my first patient at that point, because he turned to me and sort of poured it all out to me. And I remember saying to him, before I realized it was an interpretation quite, well, it's not your boss that you're worked up about, it's your father. You're going on about, you're saying exactly the same things about your boss that I've heard you say for years about your father. And this actually did get through to him, and he afterwards expressed a lot of gratitude to me for saying that, because he thought that had pulled him out of it. And in fact, he did get the job and kept it, so on. So I suppose if one's got behind one that sense of assurance of reversal, of that, and also I seem to have some sort of flair as a medical student of being someone that other people talk to. You know, I became the sort of person that fellow students and other people seek me out to tell things to.
and you align yourself to appreciate yourself more. For so often you overlook this level of self-awareness, seeking some abstraction, seeking some sense of power, seeking, unfortunately, some sense of control. But awareness starts with your body, and appreciation of your body is a key to awareness, self-awareness, that you see it.
Christmas tree after a while, but it does take a maintenance base of mass and take it on a daily basis. A little bit more that's in our formulas, you have to take it an external amount to use and use it with the receptor to increase this ability of the body to not flush out every time that you take niacin. Now, to control the energy level from the piezoelectric effect, the RNA type virus covers itself with a phosphate and a DNA type virus with a sugar, forming this special type of coating. The virus, like any living organism, produces waste. These wastes are accumulated in the center of the rod just formed and will be called adenine, guanine, thiamine, and cytosine, according to the type of virus in the bipole. The process to make the coating is accomplished at the expense of the electrical charge accumulated by the piezoelectric field. At the end of the charge, to remain active, the group of viruses removes the coating that is now in the form of the capital T, and exposes itself to the high-frequency sound produced by the DNA, and the process starts all over again. And due to this phenomena, the DNA always has enough bases available to produce RNA strains and to reproduce itself. Now let's go back and talk about the composition of the 6 billion steps. Suppose we twist this strange ladder so many times as to have only a few steps for every turn of the coil so formed. And these steps we would just call base pairs per turn. Since every base has a different polarity according to the code formed by the passing generations, the DNA can be compared to the multipolarity rotor of an alternator. In the alternator, the speed is inversely proportional to the number of poles, and the output power is directly proportional to the energy applied. At every electrical impulse flowing through the nervous system, the DNA moves back and forth as many degrees as one base is separated from the next one. The more base pairs per turn, the less degree of DNA has to move and the less energy is required to make it vibrate. And there are controlling factors also for the DNA to reproduce itself and to create a new cell. First of all, you have the kinetic energy of the H bonds. You have the number of base pairs per turn in the double helix. You have the energy and frequency of the charge ions traveling along the nervous system. For example, the DNA of an embryo cell in the mother womb has 46 base pairs per turn. The kinetic energy of the electrons in the H bond increases and the charged ions from the mother are unchanged. The DNA produces one cell every minute and so on. By the time the fetus is in the 10th lunar month, the single DNA, half from the mother, half from the father, has already reproduced itself more than 6 trillion times. Now when the baby is born, the slowing process of reproduction increases. At the age of 2, the DNA winds again to have 22 base pairs per turn. At 14, 14 at the age of 21, and 10 at the age of 35. From the age of 35 to 55, the base pairs per turn in the DNA does not change. But approximately at the age of 55, the base pairs per turn are reduced to 6. By this time, the kinetic energy of the electron in the H-bond, energy of the charged ion becomes very weak, and the DNA stops reproducing itself, and the aging process begins.
Yes, sir, Ellie. Just look at that liner, huh?
Daddy, what do people do all the time on a boat?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose they walk around the deck and play cards and read and that sort of thing. Then they have dances.
Dances on a boat?
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be awful tippy?
Well, that's what they do on them big modern liners.
Daddy, why don't we go on one?
Well, maybe we will, if I can save up some money.
Rich.
Oh, there are lots of people poorer than us, Ellie. You wouldn't like your daddy any better if he were rich, would you?
Oh, yes, I would, Daddy.
Well, it might happen someday.
These things, this disguise does not matter. What is important is what you are hearing and its application to your life. I come to each of you, not through the bodily form, but through the God-spirit form, which is unlimited. That is how I have helped every single one of you. That is how I have opened the doors for you. That is how I have manifested for you. On a physical level, I will sit here and blab. Words that sometimes I cannot find what they mean through feeling. The pure spirit and pure knowing, that is how I manifest and help each one of you. And that manifestation becomes a solidity, for I send the thought to your brain receiving unit that it can be housed and felt in the body as an upliftment. That is how it is done.
mean, if you could peek in, you know, on a person who's creating their reality, and at the same time peek in on a person who's co-creating it, on the surface it would look the same. They're both meditating, they're both involved in using technique, and they're working with their unseen friends. But there's something more that the co-creator is doing that the creator is not. And therein lies the illusion, therein lies the elusiveness, therein lies the potential self-deception that can be a destructive. The difference between a creator and a co-creator is subtle, admittedly so. But that difference is also all-pervasive. The difference lies in the understanding and in the wisdom. The understanding, how you act, and the wisdom, how you live. Understanding is awareness put into action. Wisdom is understanding that you live 24 hours a day, that is a part of you automatically. The difference between creating and co-creating lies in how you act when you go about the process and program, how you act when you go about implementing your metaphysics and working in your world spiritually. The difference lies in the wisdom, how you live your life. How you live your life, whether you're being metaphysical right now or not, whether you're being spiritual right now or not. Therein lies the difference, in that sense of your understanding and your wisdom of the depth and the meaning of co-creation. The difference also lies in your motivation and in your intention. Motivation is what you are trying to accomplish. It is the why. It is the why you're doing what you're doing. And the intention is what you expect to happen, what you expect to come out of it, what you expect the result to be. And therefore the intention, the motivation and intention of the co-creator is different than that of the creator. It is a subtle but nonetheless important difference in motivation and intention that separates creation from co-creation. And finally, the difference lies in the resonance. The difference lies in the resonance between technique and realness. Last month when we spoke of the gentle walk, we talked about those who want to see the higher self as a technique. Those in a certain humanistic psychological venue, those with a certain bent or passion for a certain kind of metaphysics or spirituality, want to look upon the higher self as simply a technique, an interesting way of processing, an interesting way of creating reality, an interesting way of discovering more about yourself, a philosophical approach, a concept. Rather than looking at your higher self as a real, living, breathing, if you will, consciousness that has its own identity, that has its own motivation, that has its own direction, of which you are a part. And the difference in that sense, as we detailed last month, between technique and realness, is also the difference that shows up between creation and co-creation. When you are involved in co-creation, you are very much involved in the realness of your metaphysics, not just in the technique of it. In the realness of your spirituality, not just in the technique of it. In the realness, if you will, of God, Goddess, all that is, not just the technique of a concept of God, Goddess, and all that is. And so we would suggest here that the subtle difference that doesn't show on the surface, that doesn't show to the mere view and to the mere surface understanding, lies in the understanding and in the wisdom, in the motivation and in the intention, and in the resonance of the creation in which you are involved.
you. During the time they are being used, they're converting all the negative energies, processing all the negative energies to ground. The Omnion by itself is also used as an interastral projection and communications device. And it can be used with one irradiator or seven irradiators, or in this case, four irradiators. Next thing we always tell people, the best place we find is to put the master crystal is directly below the Omnion in the center of the system. Because during the full moon, when the master crystal is receiving a lot of negative energy, the Omnion, which also has crystal in it, is pulling out this negative energy out of the master crystal so that the master crystal can function, cleansing the energies as they come through and putting more positive energies back out. And during the full moon is, of course, the time when the master crystal has to work very hard at doing this.
But apparently the plane made its first and probably its last flight in 1985 in Chupati. Apparently this craft was later flown, like I said, according to this, in 1985. And the first flight was witnessed amongst a throng of persons, you know, over 100 years later. Almost 100 years later. And this is quite astounding because the plane ascended to a distance of 1,500 feet before coming down, and it says that it was equipped with automatic devices for lowering down when it reached a certain height. So, after the death of his wife in 1917, Mr. Talpati had lost all interest, and later his relatives sold all of the different pieces and everything after this demonstration in the modern age. And it's just one of those passing events that came and went, but it was actually demonstrated, and this is documented evidence in India of the actual flying of a Vimana. What we feel, see, hear, and project through our neurological system outwards towards the present projected environment is the living condition of our reality.
And so aware of your body and relaxed. Come with us now on a gentle journey. A gentle journey to a beautiful meadow. And as you sense now, as we describe this meadow beautiful that stretches out before you, rolling hills of gentle green grasses and motley shades, with a wind that dances across it, leaving its path, and then it's gone. And beautiful wildflowers splashing here and there, brilliant colours, not in a pattern that you understand, but a pattern of nature. And trees, some of them broadleaf, creating circles of shade, and others evergreen, creating long stretches of shade at the base of their elegance and their majesty. And over the scene stretched taut a blue cover of sky, with occasional white puffs of cloud and a brilliantly warm sun. And as far as you can see here before you and to your left and right, this beautiful meadow stretches. And this is where the earth knows herself, is confident and aware. For everything that randomly placed is placed with an elegant randomness, a godly randomness, an expression of the god, goddess, all that is, a painting, a tapestry, a beauty, an elegance, a simplicity. A scene that you could overlook. A scene that you could see every day. And you are aware. And you feel that awareness. And that beauty. And as you stand here quietly, you know something now. You have impact. You can change it. Think of night. And the sun is gone. And the blue stretch becomes deep blue. Or black. The green of the grass becomes like a sea of darkness, and the trees casting shadows are like large statues. And as you think of the daylight and dawn, you can see the hues of pink and red stretching across, colouring the green and the trees, stretching across brilliantly, streaking across the sky like a magnificent abstraction of watercolour. And as you think of midday, you can feel the yellow warmth of the sun and see the brilliance of the meadow. And you are aware of yourself and your impact.
Coca-Cola has had one of the most guarded recipes in history. Here's how to make your own. Mix 2,400 grams of sugar in water, add 37 grams of caramel, 3.1 grams caffeine, 11 grams phosphoric acid. Extract the cocaine from coca leaves. Discard the cocaine. Soak the coca leaves in 20 grams of 20% alcohol. Add this liquid to the syrup. Add 30 grams lime juice, 0.27 grams lime oil, 0.20 grams cassia, 0.07 grams nutmeg oil. Add to 4.9 grams of 95% alcohol and shake. Add 27 grams of water. Let stand 24 hours. Separate a cloudy layer. Add to the syrup. Add 19 grams of glycerin and 1.5 grams vanilla extract. Add water treated with chlorine to make 1 gallon syrup. Mixed with carbonated water. For Coca-Cola.
At least in the Worm Ouroboros, which I have never learned to pronounce. That's a gamble. E.R. Edison is one of those. Edison, on the one hand, Tolkien is a better writer than Edison in the simple sense that Edison falls into the class of the great, rich, ripe overwriters, and about one novel is the only one where it works. But he's a maker too, and he sees his world so clearly and so plainly before him that he will spend 8 pages describing what a particular palace looks like. And I don't think it ever occurs to Edison that you wouldn't be as interested in the interior decoration of the Queen's bathroom than he is. As I wrote in the, what turned out to be the foreword to the Tolkien Reader, the best of it has always been discovering strangers who have somehow also read this book, and then the whole trip just goes by as you talk about it. And now there are no strangers anymore.
I couldn't even grasp what had happened to me. I only knew I must tell Polina that our money was gone.
Gone? All gone?
Completely. The Frenchman met me in the corridor, told me he's waiting to escort you for a walk.
Let him wait.
He seemed pleased.
He should be. The general is completely mortgaged to him. If Granny doesn't die, he gets everything.
I think one of the biggest problems in the way music is going nowadays and the way people look at it is that people are musically segregated or walking around with musical blinders so that they only like one type of music, one style, one genre, and anything outside of that is not good for them. It's fostering a kind of attitude that tells people if you like the Blasters and X, then you can't like Culture Club and the Police. If you like Black Flag and the Minutemen, then you can't like Soft Cell. If you like 60s influence Paisley Underground music, you can't like roots and rockabilly music. And if you're going to like any kind of music and be serious about it, then it better not be heavy metal or mainstream hard rock.
Plenty of excess energy, doesn't need the Omnium, per se, so you can swing the Omnium up and out of the way. on its orbital arrangement. Now, usually what people do is with the master crystal in the center of the system, we'll start to program for other crystals, what we call amplifier crystals. These amplifier crystals can be placed in the vicinity around or surrounding the master crystal. And eventually you'll find that you'll have several large crystals similar in size to the master crystal. But like I said before earlier when I talked about crystals, you don't want them quite as big. But the system will attract automatically the kinds of crystals that it wants, and it will reject the crystals that it don't.
As you stand in the matter of your reality. And as you slowly turn around, for you've not looked yet behind you, you are a bit startled at first to see huge mountainous boulders. For you half expected to see as far as you could see this direction too. But here you stand, right there, within touch. They almost startled you. In fact, you do reach out and you touch the stone, you feel its heart. And you feel the pulsating life and energy that flows through these appearing to be inanimate stones. And you know you can love these rocks, these boulders, these mountainous craggy boulders. And you can help them. And you can respond with respect. You can have impact, even upon the boulders of your mind.
That again, what we feel, see, hear, and project through our neurological system outwards towards the present projected environment is the living condition of our reality. Our living condition is the immediate environment, and our whole existence is created by the energetic thought forms projected out each moment into it. This statement, when you read it, you get this feeling that, hey, if it's really real for me, if I'm really experiencing higher consciousness in my relationship to understanding the UFO phenomena and different metaphysical type thoughts, you will find in the moment-to-moment existence that what you feel, what you see, what you hear, and ultimately what you are projecting outwards from this realization, which is held in your mind and your heart, outward through your neurological system, in other words, what you're projecting out through your nervous system, towards the current, right now, the projected environment that is sitting in front of you, that means the people you meet, the work you do at your job, the relationship you have with your family, your kids, all the people that you're close with, the relationship even with yourself when you're alone, the relationship you have with everything you do, the relationship you have with driving in your car if somebody cuts you off, the relationship you have when you go in to get some gas or you go into the grocery, everything, what you feel, see, hear, and project through your nervous system outwards towards the present projected environment, whatever it may be, good or bad, that is the living condition of your reality.
Oh, look at that big boat. That's the boat I want to go on.
That's the Herrivik.
Oh, is it really?
Indeed it is, sir. Yes, sir, the Herrivik. One of the biggest afloat. I signed a steward on many a boat like that. But now, in my old age, they've laid me off.
Mm. Oh, well, we all have hard luck sometimes. Well,
some of us has it all the time, sir. This country ain't no place for an old man. It's for the young and the strong it is.
Daddy, let's go away. I don't like this man.
All right, Ellie, we'll go take a look at the sea lions.
You couldn't find me the price of a cup of coffee now, could you, sir? Just a nickel. That's all an old man needs.
Well, all right. Here.
Thank you, thank you. God bless you, sir. Thank you, sir.
But, Daddy, Mommy said never to let people speak to you in the street, and to call a policeman if they did, and to run away as fast as you could on account of kidnappers.
No danger of their kidnapping me, Ellie.
When I grow up, will I be able to talk to people on the street like that?
No, dear, you certainly will not.
If I'd been a boy, could I?
Well, I guess you could.
Look at that boat, Daddy. There are an awful lot of people coming here, aren't there?
Yep, they sure are.
Memory will have to have been carried to the the nucleus and cytoplasm of a zygote. If an ancestral memory of an archetypical order, and it's the only link through which an ancestral, through actually one cell, then it seems to me just as plausible that one cell and its prenatal derivative could receive some registration of patterning before neural tissue is based on, because the one cell must somehow or other carry the genetic memory that is mapped into the nervous system, if it's archetypal, when the nervous system is developed. It seems quite plausible that certain biopatterns of could be are carried from before nervous system is differentiated and imprinted into the nervous system from pre-neural system.
I'd like to change the subject slightly. Many argue that neurosis is a historical phenomenon, that the kind of neurosis described by Freud was created by the conditions of his time. Would you extend this to, say, schizophrenia, if we may use the label? Might this also be a historical condition?
Well, in the sense that we believe that the gene pool is reasonably constant, but our environment, particularly the artifactual human environment that we create for ourselves in terms of culture, is in process of continued change. So one would think that there will always be shifting nuances that are the outcome of the product of our genetic response system to changing environmental circumstances. So what is 20th century schizophrenia is possibly a variation on a theme of which is a product of our genetic constitution, our 20th century environment. Another variation would be the 16th century environment. In other words, that the clinical picture of certain conditions where the relevant environmental variable is our cultural variables rather than physical constants would be open to transformation with transforming environmental circumstances. Of course, it's very difficult with Freud's terminology, because we've got some. If we go back on Freud's five original studies of hysteria and the people he called hysteria, a fair number of them would now be called schizophrenic. I mean, among these five hysterics, if I remember, there's one who had visual hallucinations, one had olfactory hallucinations, and quite a lot of schizoid phenomena. I think one of them committed suicide eventually. I think one ended up in a mental hospital. We remember that, say, what American psychiatrists now call schizophrenia has a big overlap of what Freud was calling hysteria. It just adds a bit more piquancy to the semantic confusion of the subject.
Yes, I'd like to stick with the diagnostic dilemma. Do you feel that diagnosis is actually helpful to psychiatrist and patient, or do you think it's merely a label which disguises a complex reality?
Well, I think the reality is very complex, and there can be some labels that disguise complex reality and other labels that bring out clarity within and enable us to see in an articulated manner the complexity. I have got absolutely no objection to naming, to classifying, to ordering our universe. Including the domain that psychiatry is concerned with, to ordering it, to giving it an order, and to putting it in sets, and where there's a homogeneity between all the members of the one set. The argument is not against the process of naming or ordering specifically, but on two scores. The naming and ordering of our phenomenon. In the sphere of psychiatry, this naming and ordering regarded as a branch of medicine means that we have to suppose that the phenomena that are being named are of the same order as the phenomena studied in the rest of medical pathology. It isn't quite, the phenomena aren't quite of the same order because they were studying a person's words. So of course we study a person's words neurologically and so on, but we it's a person's words, not so much in terms of indications of an organic order through the words, but confusion we suppose in the connotation or significance of words, both as heard and as uttered.
This is the end of side one.
Object happening, work, event, or production more resonant than it was yesterday? Movies about the Strategic Air Command with Jimmy Stewart, Hubert Humphrey speeches, old Lawrence Welk records, news photographs of Mayor Wagner, Senate testimony by Robert McNamara, interviews with J. Edgar Hoover. These would be the artifacts of the new art movement. Camp was out and shit was in.
co-creation, to look at it more deeply. Co-creation is a process of reaching beyond. Co-creation is a process of reaching beyond. To co-create, you need to reach beyond the normal human potential. You need to reach beyond the traditional metaphysical realm. You need to reach beyond that which you would learn in the books that you would read or the courses that you attend. You need to reach beyond even the words as we speak to you this evening or as we speak to you in any of the workshops or times that we work with you. You need to reach beyond your normal potential or even the heightened potential of your humanness. You need to reach beyond. You need to reach beyond.
Saying, wait a minute, Mr. B, this thing has turned into some kind of totally serious manifesto grant proposal sort of thing. I didn't pay top dollar for this bootleg in order to get a lecture.
It's not something else that you imagine yourself to be or wish you were, but it's exactly what you're projecting out right at this time. So take this idea, realize that our living condition is our immediate environment, and that our whole existence is created by the energetic thought forms that are projected out each moment into it. And this will make things very exciting and very clear for you. You can check yourself on this. I'm now just beginning to embark on a national tour to promote our Citizens for Scientific Reality campaign. I feel that when people discover the UFO phenomena and all of our limited concepts of thought and science, government, politics, religion, and education, when these are all challenged, I believe there will be a tremendous movement towards some of the thoughts and ideas shared here with you on this tape series. And I believe that there will be a revolution in the total thought process. And you can see it going on in our world today. Something is about to radically change. So as I go out on this tour, I hope to be entering your homes through the television and the radio. And I hope to see you at some of our seminars. And I would really look forward to sharing this whole existence with you. And I hope to meet you personally someday.
one who ever gave you something you didn't want. You now forgive anyone who ever gave you
forgive
something you didn't want.
Who ever gave you
something you now forgive anyone. I now forgive everyone.
Now forgive anyone
who ever gave you something. I now forgive everyone.
I now forgive everyone
something I did ever gave me
something I didn't want.
I now forgive everyone who ever gave me something I didn't want.
You forgive yourself.
I now
for having
everyone
things you never
ever
gave me
something I didn't want.
Forgive yourself for having accepted
you
things
forgive
you
yourself
never really wanted.
For having accepted things you never really wanted.
You forgive yourself for having accepted things.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things I never really wanted.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things I never really wanted.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things I never really wanted.
Things I never really wanted.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things
when
you mean
no,
you say no.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things
you say yes.
When you mean no,
you say no.
I forgive myself
for having accepted
things
you say yes.
When you mean no,
you say no.
I forgive myself
for having accepted things
when you mean no,
you say yes.
When you mean no,
you say no.
I forgive myself
yes,
for having
when
accepted
mean,
things.
No,
I say
no.
When you mean no,
when I say yes,
I forgive myself
yes, for having
when I mean no,
I say no.
When you mean no,
when I say yes,
I mean no.
When you
mean
no,
when you
mean no. This was from the country silos of Siberia. I won't have to write any more goddamn disarmament poems. When that consortium inferno blast down La Cienega melting Harvey leaders and Mercedes and Beverly Sanders and leave green hillsides dead for a quarter million years, I won't signal my turn of Pico. No wide-eyed creeps are gonna kill me downtown for the 30 bucks I got at a poetry reading. When L.A. gets nuked, I won't have to watch my ass turn black from cancer 2012. I won't pay Pacific Bell's federal excise tax to stuff Pentagon desks for World War IV. I'll never have to read the L.A. Weekly again.
I won't... And letting yourself be pleased.
conditions at the present time, I am afraid they will bring no more than their value as old material. Sincerely, yours. Amen.
Sensing a level of communication and a level that you do not understand but that you can feel, you notice now an opening, not a cave but an opening, a passageway through the rock, and you move toward this opening, all the while keeping touch of the rock, feeling its impact on you and knowing you're having impact on the rock. And you begin to pass through the opening. It is narrow and not all can pass. But you wend your way through, following the zigzags and the curves and the turns, ducking under certain rocks, standing tall and squeezing through narrow passageways. And as you wend your way through, you come to the last zig or zag, and you step out upon a bluff. A beautiful bluff that stretches a good distance, but a bluff nonetheless, overlooking what is below, beautiful jaggedy mountain tops, a brilliant valley, a brilliant range of mountains above which you stand on your bluff. And you move toward the edge of the bluff, and you look over it, and you look down, and you see below you, and to the left and the right and above you, as far as you can see, above you the sky, again so brilliantly blue, and below you, for stretches as far as you can imagine, mountains, jaggedy, rocky, rocky mountains. And it's a majestic scene, and a beautiful scene, and you sense the power, the power. And you stand at the edge of your bluff, and you look out over, and you have an awareness of yourself, oh so tiny, oh so minuscule, such a speck of nothing compared to all this which you view, but you have an awareness of yourself nonetheless, and you are aware, and the feel of the awareness and the power. You feel an awareness and the power, and you are filled with independence and determination. You are aware and powerful, filled with independence and determination. You are aware and powerful, filled with independence and determination. You feel the independence and the determination like the jaggedy rocks below, stretching tall and proud and powerful, in harmony with your reality.
Robert Dow, Dr. William Hale at Dow Chemical, began to research back in the 50s with this energy. And they found that anything that had a cell and consciousness in it put out an electronic field. And, of course, we've been into the intimacies of that electronic field, and we talked about the sensitivity of the DNA. Dr. Rickenbach in Germany, back in World War II, had done a lot of research along these lines. And so by the time William Hale had done it at Dow Chemical, it began to be known as a common thing. It was presented to the United States military also, but they weren't really interested in it as a possibility of a beam weapon. The ones that really picked up on it were the Russians. And I'm sure some of you remember back in 1987 when a 747 Japanese jet flew through this what appeared to be a hydrogen bomb explosion going off, but there was no explosion, there was no heat, no radiation, but it looked like that, visually it looked that way up near the North Pole, north of Alaska. And so this energy that killed these insects is something that we work with all of the time, only we don't kill things with it, we heal with it instead. You can work either way naturally with this kind of energy. It's the same energy field that goes into the human body from the soul. It's characterized by the soul, and it enters into the body when the female first gets pregnant with the male sperm. Now, shortly after the pregnancy, the nature of the spirit records a particular vibratory pattern in the soul, and this then galvanizes the iron in the fetus of the embryo, and this galvanic action, remember, of the iron within the red blood cell, which we've already talked about, begins to form by its characteristic energy field, what we call fingerprints. Now, at the same time, the Pleiadians and the Greys and the good and the bad, both sides of the extraterrestrials, good or we call the not so good one, prefer to say that rather than bad, because everything balances itself eventually anyway. But they are both aware of the same type of frequency and identification of a soul. And so as a result, when a Pleiadian family energy field leaves, meaning someone in the Pleiades dies or leaves their body, they're easier to find, whether they go to an Earth body or here on Earth or some other system, or they can find them eventually because they know how to look for the essence of the soul that forms the fingerprints. So the human kingdom can recognize the soul by its fingerprint patterns, and the Pleiadians can recognize them before the person is born.
Your metaphysical tradition into a realm that is much deeper. You need, in order to co-create, to establish a spirituality that is deeper, a deeper sense of spirituality that is not taught, a deeper sense of spirituality that at least has never been taught in the physical realm, is only taught perhaps on other levels. And therefore it is to reach beyond that human, metaphysical and spiritual potential into realms that are yet unknown, into realms that you haven't explored, or that you don't know the steps and you don't know the techniques. It is truly to become the explorer, truly to become that pioneer, to reach beyond. Now, there are some, and in your past as humanity, there have been those rare and exceptional individuals who have accidentally stumbled upon this realm, this resonance that is called co-creation. They've accidentally come across it in their own avenues of growth, in their own exploration. Most who have stumbled upon it, however, retreat in confusion. They retreat in confusion because they don't know what they're doing, they don't know how to operate there, and they don't know how to maintain the resonance once they've gotten there. Many will get lost in the confusion also, get lost in the paradoxes, get lost in the deception and elusiveness of what co-creation is, rendering themselves ineffective, rendering themselves in a state of impotentia. And therefore they might as well not have stumbled upon the realm, because it doesn't do anything to them. And there are a rare few, admittedly so, who have stumbled into this realm quite accidentally and have scrambled to find their equilibrium, and in so doing have benefited from the treats of co-creation, have discovered its magic, have discovered its mystery, and are able to function in that co-creating capacity without the confusion, without the paradox, to create for themselves an incredibly delightful, magical, mystical, reality that they can fully relish, to relish the treats of co-creation.
A lot of times contactees are even found before they're even born on the physical plane because of the vibratory energy field that the mother has around her. Which is...
Now, there's one thing I want to clarify at this point in time, because a lot of people wonder about these grays. Are they good or bad? And one thing that I want to say is that they come here. I had one contact with them, and it was uncomfortable for me because I'm not mentally geared to deal with them like somebody like, say, Whitley Strieber is, but first contact I had with him was about 1980, and the energy hit my head and my consciousness, and it wasn't like a Pleiadian contact. What happened when the energy hit me, it went around and around and around inside my head, and eventually it slowed down after a few days, and I was able to grab the words out of this beam of energy. And what I found out from them was that they are scavengers of energy. The grays go through the galaxies, and they pick up stray or spurious non-harmonic energy and process it into harmonic energy. And if you look at their metabolism and that, you can begin to understand how this is possible. So this does have, they're like, you know, like a jellyfish or a piece of a shrimp or a lobster or something at the bottom of the sea. They have a scavenging capability. Now the thing about the grays is that because they've done a lot of wild breeding and intergenetic breeding with other things, they have a group oversoul, but they don't have an individual soul on the lower levels. So I think one of the things they're trying to do from the human kingdom is to build up a soul where they can have some kind of a hereditary reincarnating process like the Pleiadians do, or we do, or other people.
Well, the president, contemplating this perspective, could not be altogether happy. The Great Society is a dud, was his lament. I don't even have an issue with which to slow down the Negroes and their rights. The president believed very much in image. He believed the history, which made the headlines each day, was more real to the people than the events themselves.
Aware and powerful, and you are filled with independence and determination. And as you stand here at the edge of the bluff, looking out over all of reality, you are now open to the inner awareness, the inner light within. You are now open to the inner awareness, and the inner light. You are aware of yourself. You are aware. You are feeling, and you are knowing, and you are acting out of self-awareness. You are self-aware. You are aware. You are transforming, and aware of that transformation. You are transforming, and aware of that transformation. You are transforming, becoming more and more self-aware as you stand here at the edge of your bluff.
Aren't you supposed to be funny, sort of? Well, oops, I am, sort of. And that's my very next point. Appropriation, by its very nature, often results in something funny. and funny can be just as important in life and culture and art as all that serious stuff that will get you ideological followers or a grant. Let's find out by putting aside all this theoretical rhetoric and turning to the experiential reality of what I may or may not be describing. I have here a demonstration tape, an example of found sound appropriation and transformation. And here it is.
Taken care of and offered sanctuary where environmentally the circumstances would be as minimally threatening, dangerous, persecuting and whatnot as we could make them. So it's one of my regrets that not all but so many mental hospitals are so far away from being places of hospitality, you might say, for someone who's very frightened. But of course, I really do say, of course, we have to protect society from dangerous, irresponsible people, are recalcitrant to reason, we can't do anything about, and so forth. The corrective function of the mental hospital is a slightly too Chinese for me, I don't like the idea of being compulsory correction centres. I would rather that be straightforward crime and punishment and prison than correction administered under the name of therapy.
Now you immaculate, wonderful entities who want to go out and try to heal everyone else, but now you think you know how it is done. Well, you do. And you can send thought unto them, and the thought will go directly to them and will be seen directly by the God who is an unlimited entity. But unless that fits in with the program of their altered thinking, you're not going to succeed. For it will not permit the thought to go past itself to occur within the body to help it be healed.
Co-creation is the process of reaching beyond. But it's more than that. Co-creation is also the process of encountering, unfolding, and befriending the most remarkable energy of all, which we call the energy of together. It is a process of encountering, unfolding, and befriending a most remarkable energy of together. You are aware in your growth and in your changes, in your evolution, of the energy within. Indeed, as you discovered metaphysics, as you discovered your first how to improve the quality of your life course, however many years or weeks or months ago that was for you, you began to discover the energy within. You began to learn that inside of you is an incredible energy out of which you can make your life better, out of which you can get the job or the relationship or find the right wardrobe or you can get the money or the success or whatever you're after, that you can have what you want by using an energy inside of you. And despite the criticisms of meism and selfishness, indeed you sought that energy and you did discover your human potential and reach beyond it to begin to discover your metaphysical and your spiritual potential as well. And you began to become more and more aware that inside of you, you have access to an incredible power, an incredible energy, an incredible power and energy that you can use to potentially or literally create whatever reality you want, privately, and maybe even socially, and possibly, if you dare think it, globally. You have learned of the energy within, despite the criticisms, despite the distractions that have hit you and have hurt you. You have nonetheless learned of this energy within. You have also, at the same time, learned at least of the energy without, the potential and the power of what other people can create, the energy within, the potential and power of what you can create, the energy without, the potential and power of what others can create. But there's another energy. There's another energy that is here. And that is the energy that happens not within and not without, but happens between. And we call the energy, that energy, the energy of together. And what's so very appropriate as we look at the concepts of co-creation as that energy of between, of reaching not just beyond, but reaching between to create the energy of together. That at this time in your world, most excitedly, most positively, that this is occurring. Because right now, also, something that's happening delightfully and excitingly in your world, that you even have heard about, many of you on your standard of consensus reality, CNN News, yes, is the experimentations that have happened with fusion. Now, you've heard of fission. You know about fission. You may not know what it is precisely, but it has to do with splitting the atom, taking an atom and accelerating at such a pace that it causes the atom to break apart, and in so breaking apart, releasing a massive amount of energy that is used for bombs initially, and then hopefully they thought used for energy as they created the nuclear plants here in California and all over the place, all over your world. Indeed, with all their problems, with all the potential dangers of leakage and meltdown and plutonium pollution and things of this sort. And the whole basis of that energy was on dividing, upon breaking apart. Scientists have been looking at the, quote, impossibility of putting energy together. And perhaps by combining energy, they could also find a release of excess energy. And thus the concept of fusion existed. And it was about, what, a month or a month and a half ago that certain scientists, quite unorthodoxly, but nonetheless, created fusion, the bringing together of atoms to make two into one, in a certain sense, to bring together atoms to release an excess amount of energy. Now, upon the completion of their experiment, there were the detractors, right? Oh, no, it can't be done, can't be done. I've been working on it for 10 years, and I can't do it, so it can't be done. We've spent millions of dollars in research. They can't possibly do it for a mere $100,000 in the kitchen sink. It can't be done. No, it can't be done, and I'll prove it, they said, and thus, indeed, numerous experiments saying, we couldn't do it. And therefore, the waffling back and forth. Are you going to have fusion in your world, or are you not? And I would suggest you haven't decided yet, as a whole. The jury's still out. One day it's yes, the next day it's no. Well, these two scientists, one from Utah and one from England, rather once again have demonstrated a second time the repeatability, the standard of your science, the repeatability of this experiment of fusion, of bringing things together to create solution, to create the answers, to release an energy that is greater than the sum of its parts, the synergy of energy. And although there still will be waffling, and although it will not be something that is applicable in the next 6 months, or something you're going to power your homes and your factories with in the next couple of years, we would suggest here that you are slowly making the decision to allow fusion, the bringing together of energy, to be a part of your world. And therefore, within a very short time, fusion is going to be a reality. Room temperature fusion is going to be a reality. And although that sounds, well, that's nice, that's very good, what's that mean to me? We would suggest what it means is an answer to all your energy problems. And the advent of fusion is perhaps comparable to the discovery of fire, as far as what it's going to do, as far as humanity is concerned, over the next however long period of time. Imagine what it would have been like to be around when fire was discovered and all its possibilities were there. Well, you're there. You're around when a new kind of fire, a fire of bringing together the energy of atomic power to create safe energy, with no pollutants, with no risks in the sense of accidents, no destruction of your planet should somebody push the wrong button. And in that sense, you are on that brink of that incredible human breakthrough. What 2 years ago was said to be impossible is now becoming possible by bringing energy together. And it is this kind of philosophical concept that is what co-creation is all about. It is about bringing and discovering the energy of together. Now, the energy of together is very appealing, and it's also very elusive. It's very appealing. We would suggest those that we call the non-metaphysical spiritual people, and we refer to them that way because we very clearly say everybody's spiritual. Everybody has a relationship with God, Goddess, all that is, even if they turn their back on that energy, even if they deny its existence, that's still a relationship, and therefore everyone is spiritual. No one can escape that energy. But there are those who are non-metaphysical in their spirituality, and we would suggest those non-metaphysical spiritual people are very attracted to the energy of together, but they don't have any access to it. They do not have access to that energy. And the reason they do not have access, because in order to get to that energy of together, you must be willing to embrace the energy within and the energy without. And those non-metaphysical spiritual people are more than willing to embrace the energy without. But indeed, they are terrified many times, and they reject and dismiss the energy within. They dismiss the energy within by calling it self-centered, by calling it self-serving, by calling it meism, by calling it totally hedonistic or nihilistic. They embrace the energy without and not sensing that the world is happening outside of me, beyond me, by other people creating it, ready and willing to give the energy without. But indeed, dismiss the energy within and reject it out of guilt, out of fear, and often out of loathing. And so therefore they cannot, quote, get here from there. Because although they embrace eagerly the energy without, they reject and dismiss the energy within, and therefore the energy between is beyond their reach. Well, those such as yourself who are metaphysical spiritual people, who indeed have that same spirituality, that same search and quest for a relationship with God, with a relationship with God, Goddess, all that is, and indeed are doing so in a metaphysical fashion, you, however, are very familiar with the energy within, but alas, the energy between is often as difficult for you to acquire and achieve as it is for them. And the reason is because in your embrace and subsequent defense of the energy within, you often reject the energy without. You reject it as, that's my parents' generation. That's the consensus. That's the way it used to be done in the stupid old age. I'm new age and everything is different and I do everything totally opposite of what was done before. And so therefore energy without, boo hiss, that's bad, terrible stuff. I'm going to just focus on the energy within, and the way to solve all the problems of the world is just solve them inside of me. And if I'm happy, the world will be happy. Yeah? And if I don't think there's hunger, there won't be. And if I don't think there's violence, there won't be. And if I don't think people are dying, they won't. Well, maybe I just need to try a little harder. Yes. I need to love myself more. That's it. That's it. The panacea to all my problems, yes? Or is it the placebo? But nonetheless, we would suggest here that many find themselves absolutely embracing the energy within and defending their right. I'm not self-centered. I'm not self-serving. I'm not, in that sense, totally hedonistic. I'm not nihilistic and wanting the destruction of the world around me. Not at all. But I don't want anything to do with the energy without. I don't want to have anything to do with what the world or what people outside of me are able to create. I want to say they can't create anything, they don't exist. I create it all. I create it all. They aren't there, they aren't real, that's so. But in your creation of it all, you gave them an energy that is the energy without. But in that sense, often you reject it, as we say, in your defense, and therefore you also have difficulty touching or knowing or experiencing that energy between. You must be willing to embrace both the energy within and the energy without. And you must become competent in functioning with the energy within, the world you create, and the energy without, the world you allow to be created, in order to experience the energy between or the energy together. Co-creation is working with that, is a process of discovering and experiencing and working with the energy that is together. together.
I think it's interesting because they are scavengers. When they were out in the New Mexico area back in the early 40s, late 40s, mid 40s, their energy fields, their plutonium reactors in their spaceships were picking up radio frequency energies. And of course these radio frequency energies were over boiling their pot or giving them too much energy and causing a breakdown, which caused a flash inside the ships, which then burned them but brought the ships down intact. It's like a miniature hydrogen bomb going off inside the cockpit of the flying vehicle because of absorbing too much energy from our radiation. So even their power plants for their systems or their spaceships were characteristically absorbing other kinds of energy. Now the Iargans, this is another group that I work with a little bit, have another purpose here, and they're the alchemists, and they teach man alchemy. For example, in 1947, when Hoffman, working at Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland, discovered the lysergic acid on the rye mold and had an out-of-body experience. This, because he put this in his body, caused a chemical change and a biochemical change in the body. And so this was necessary because it evolved man's consciousness. This happened to be that he was synthesizing something that could be found naturally in the psilocybin mushroom, but science was not aware of that effect yet in mankind. Now what the Iarguans do is when they come here, they teach man alchemy to help change the body frequencies. By changing their food habits, their nutritional habits, these kinds of things. They create what's called elixirs, and these elixirs help biochemistry receive the higher vibratory frequency of the human race as it moves on its upward evolution cycle in its ever-present course around the Pleiades. The Pleiadians, on the other hand, come to us when man's emotions are open and receptive to the fact that we are not alone. When the Pleiadians finish with us, higher races like the Andromedans or the Lyrians come, who are more on the mental plane, who don't have to work through the emotional auspices of the human race. So in each one of these extraterrestrial beings and groups that comes to us, comes in a different wave of consciousness for a different purpose.
Creation is a gift of your higher self. It is rooted. It is rooted in the higher realms and in your higher self. Now, we have been saying all along that you create your own reality, and not only do you do it consciously. And we have been suggesting that the highest truth of your physical, astral, causal, and mental worlds is that truth, that you create it all consciously. Although some pretend it's done unconsciously, some pretend it's done subconsciously, some pretend it's somewhere else, not with me, the fact is it is with you. And your job, so to speak, is to discover not only that you do create it, but that you're conscious of it, and then to work at becoming more and more and more conscious of the reality and realities that you are creating. The truth that you create your own reality is born within your human potential and born within the metaphysical spiritual potential that you develop. It is through those potentials that you come to understand that I do create my reality, and that you come to understand that I do it consciously. It is then through the very use of that potentials, personally, humanly, metaphysically and spiritually, that you develop the approaches and the techniques that allow you to become more conscious. So that in time you can be more conscious of your private reality, then of your social reality, and ultimately of your global reality. Now all of this, the understanding and development and becoming more conscious, is your creation. Co-creation comes from beyond that. It comes from your higher self. It comes from the higher realms. And therefore we would suggest that you're reaching upward through your human potential, through your metaphysical and spiritual potential, is your creation. And your higher self reaching downward to touch you, is co-creation. And it is when these two forces, reaching up as you do and reaching down as your higher self does, when these two forces touch and when they intermingle, when these strings of creation intertwine and get all tangled up together, that is when you have the magic. That is when you have the mystery of co-creation. Therefore, co-creation is an understanding and a wisdom that reaches between and reaches above. When that can make sense to you, when that can become a part of you, when that is more than words that you hastily write down in your notebook, then you understand. Then you understand the magic and the mystery. And then you have access. Then you become one of those exceptional people who is a co-creator of reality. Not everyone will be. Not everyone will be in this lifetime.
Now, we've already talked about different extraterrestrials, and this comes and goes, and as we talk and move along on a tape series. Now what I'd like to do is talk about the pyramids for a few minutes, quick review on them before we get into the systems, because the patent number, the aforementioned patent number, is the one that I have developed my systems under, and the pyramids, of course, are necessary to get you ready for the systems and the receptor. We've talked in great length on the receptor. Those of you out there that hear the tape series and want to find out which receptor is amicable to your personality, you just call in on the telephone. We have a way of testing people over the telephone. Well, our number here at Paradigm, by the way, is 714-499-2603. Or you can write to us at 1278 Glenary, Unit 255, Laguna Beach, California, 92651, which will also have the information posted on the different materials. What I want to do now is I want to talk about the pyramids. First of all, the pyridome was the first thing that we developed. And a lot of our stuff was developed by accident. Like I said earlier, I didn't put pyramids on people's heads. Gary Couture did down in his clinic on West Cliff Boulevard when he found out that the pyramid caused people to have higher energy fields. And whenever he tested them by muscle testing or kinesiology, the one that was really hybridized by John Thee at Pasadena, he found that their different people being tested with a pyramid, if they had any different kinds of vitamin leakage, deficiencies in the body here, that the pyramid would always test them strong. So if they were low in vitamin C, the pyramid would put over that area, vitamin C would test strong. If they were low in vitamin B, they put the pyramid over the area where they tested for vitamin B, they tested strong. And so from that, we were able to derive there were 7 different vibratory rates inside the pyramid that corresponded to all the different vitamins that we'd found. Back in the 70s when we introduced them, of course, the pyridome was the great seller because the greatest drug addict in those days was the American housewife strung out on Valium, to the tune of, I don't know how many billion dollars a year the drug sales were at that time. Later on, we introduced the fire dome. Now, all of the pyramids weren't developed by, perfect calculating and timing. It was all a series of accidents. I would say a controlled series of accidents.
Necessary was hampered by one fact. In the great society, there was no movement, program, plan, or ideal, which was even remotely as dramatic as the civil rights movement. So the civil rights movement was going to crowd everything else out of the newspapers. There was going to be no way to control the Negro movement and no way to convince the Negro movement that their victory was due to his particular attentions. You can never convince a movement of your power unless you can send them back after you have called them forth. So the president needed another issue. Then it came to the president. Hot damn, Vietnam. Vietnam, that little old country which had been under his nose all these years. Things were getting too quiet in Vietnam. If there was one thing hotter than Harlem in the summer, it was air raids on rice paddies and napalm on red gooks. Now we had a game. When the war got too good and everybody was given too much space to that, he could always tell the Negroes it was good time to be marching on the White House. When they got a little too serious, he could bring back Vietnam. He could even make all those Barry Goldwater rednecks and state troopers happy. That was a happy nation when everybody had something going for them. The Negroes had their civil rights and the rednecks could be killing gooks. Yes, thought the president, his friends and associates were correct in their estimate of him as a genius. Hot damn, Vietnam. The president felt like the only stud in a whorehouse on a houseboat. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll notice that up to this point, I have offered little in the way of closely reasoned, quiet argument. I did observe for myself that in the discussions about Vietnam, which took place last Saturday in Washington, and were seen by many of us on television, there was an abundance of rational arguments advanced for our escalation in Vietnam, and an equal abundance of equally rational arguments against our involvement there. Well, so far, you've received no rational arguments from me, and you are not likely to receive many more as we go on. I believe our present situation in Vietnam is so irrational that any attempt to deal with it logically is illogical in the way surrealism is illogical, and rational political discussion of Adolf Hitler's motives was illogical and then obscene.
bombing a country at the same time you are offering it aid is as morally repulsive as beating up a kid in an alley and stopping to ask for a kiss. Reading the papers these days is a nightmare of unrequited love. If one's country lives like a woman in some part of the unconscious dream life of each of us, if beneath all our criticisms and detestations of America's vulgarity, misuse of power, and sheer pompous stupidity, there's been still some optimistic love affair with the secret potentialities of this nation, some buried, unvoiced faith that the nature of America was finally good and not evil, well, that faith has taken a pistol whipping in the last months. The romance seems not even tragic or doomed, but dirty and misplaced. Still, let me assume there is some point in trying to be reasonable about Vietnam, even if it is only to discover that there is no logic in the situation. But let me at least make one straightforward attempt to understand what transpires there. I will, however, insist that the logic we employ runs close to the vein of theological argument, for we must try to speak rationally about a mystery. Since any interpretation which seeks to justify our role in Vietnam on legal grounds is criminal, since we have no legal justification to be in the country, we are in fact there, as many of you doubtless know already, in violation of the Treaty of the Geneva Conference of 1954, which we were pledged not to obstruct. The only positive argument for our presence is that while we are illegally in Vietnam, we are there at least to fight communism. Well, that is a large question. It is part of a large mystery. We may leave the largest parts of it for last. What may properly concern us first are the arguments and complexes of argument which revolve around the domino theory. Vietnam, says this much-discussed theory, is a domino supporting all the other dominoes of Southeast Asia. This is, of course, argument with the aid of metaphor, argument by image. But metaphors have curious mechanics. There is much dispute about their properties. Edgar Snow, for example, would argue that the dominoes of Southeast Asia are already falling. Insofar as they are dominoes, Indonesia has fallen and Cambodia. Both nations recognize the Viet Cong as legitimate government of South Vietnam.
Okay, this is DJ Craze and this is the Club Scene Hour. We are into the first hour of 2 o'clock, so let's get to it. DJ Bruno should be here shortly.
I'm glad you came to me.